Hello there. Welcome back to our study in Mark's Gospel. And we have now reached chapter 8. And in this chapter we find Jesus, the master servant, as it were taking a little breather out to review his team and to see if they've learned anything in this period of time that they've been with him. Now the interesting thing is, you're going to find they've learned nothing. If there's anything that shows us clearly the need for a miraculous rebirth and the work of redemption and the cross and the life of a sinner, is this chapter. But one major lesson it teaches us about the master servant, and that is in his review and seeing how little they've learnt, he never threw them away. He demonstrates the greatest quality in leadership. Pick up the bits and just start all over again. My, how much stronger our churches would be today if instead of having a disappointment from those that we give responsibilities to, we would just learn to pick up the disappointments and the bits and start in training them all over again. In those days, the multitude being very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples and said unto them, I have compassion on the multitude, because they've now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for so many of them have come from so far. And his disciples answered him, Well, from where can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? Now, we've been through this scene once before. How much have they learned? Nothing. They can only see the problem. Even knowing that this problem has been faced before and they got the answer to the problem before in turning to Jesus to be the answer, they're not doing it. They've learned nothing. And his disciples answered him, From whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? So he asked them, How many loaves have you? They have made a little bit of progress. Last time they were caught out, never even having bothered to look and see what they did have. They hadn't done what they could have done, but at least this time, there's one step forward. They've gone and done that, and they said to him, 7. And he commanded the people to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, and brake and gave to his disciples to set before them, and they did set before the people. So he's only got one answer to the problem, the same answer as last time. Take the difficulty, take what you can do, and refer it to the Father in heaven, and simply say thank you. This is your problem. Let's see how you get us out of this mess. Our trust is in thee. And he gave it to them to take to the people. Once more, he's the miracle worker, but they're going to do the serving. And they had a few small fishes, and they blessed and commanded to set them also before them. So they did eat and were filled, and they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets. And they that had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. And immediately he entered into a ship with his disciples, and came unto the parts of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came forth and began to question with him, seeking of him a sign from heaven to put him to the test. The most religious group that claimed to be the nearest to God, and what awful hearts they had. The reputation of what this man is achieving in their midst, and they in their holiness couldn't get one thing from God, and yet the hardness of their hearts is such that they're putting him to the test. For the Pharisee would never examine himself. And he sighed deeply in spirit. Not in his mind, will emotions. It's his spirit that's sighing. It's the very heart of God that's at grief here. Because he sees that these people are anything but the godly people they portray themselves to be. And they want something to look at. How modern could they be than that? Constantly today I'm confronted with people of experiences. We have things that we can see, feel and touch that proves God is there. And they don't seem to want a life of faith in the invisible things of God anymore. And he says, why does this generation seek after a sign? Truly I say unto you, there shall no sign be given unto this generation. And he left them and entered into the ship again and departed to the other side. He just wasn't going to play their game. Probably they felt that justified their right to say, well, you see what I mean? If this was who he said he was, God, if this is the Messiah, why didn't he just go ahead and prove his position to us? No. He knows now there's only one thing, and that's going to become increasingly evident as we rush towards the conclusion of this book. He's got to get to the cross fast to redeem fallen man, even fallen religious man, and bring him a new life. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread. Neither had they in the ship with them more than one loaf. These fellows seem to have a problem with bread in these chapters. And he charged them, saying, pay attention. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod. Leaven, comparable to today's yeast, a corruptive element that you knead into the dough to puff it up and fill it with gas and make it look big. You took any loaf from the supermarket and squeezed all the air out, you'd find you only have a lump of dough. And he says there are those things that you can add to your religious faith, and all it does is puff you up. And he says, so beware of the leaven of Herod. He was more concerned with his own reputation and what people thought of him than truth. He said, don't let that creep into the Christian life. Never live that Christian life on the basis of what would other people think. And they reasoned amongst themselves, saying, is it because we've no bread? They really are hung up on this bread problem, aren't they? They don't seem to be able to get past this issue. And when Jesus knew it, he said unto him, why reason you because you've no bread? Perceive ye not yet, neither understand, have ye your heart yet hardened? Is it possible that in almost 2 years of being in my company, you've seen the deaf hear, the blind see, the lame walk, the dead brought back to life, the leper cleansed, bread and fish multiplied, walking on water. You've been through all of those visual experiences. And yet, your heart is still hard. You know, that hasn't changed. Even today, there is every possibility for people to sit down in a meeting and tell you all about their wonderful experiences, and underneath all of that, there is still a hardness of heart. Having eyes, see ye not? Having ears, hear ye not? And do ye not remember? Yes, the disease of sin is so severe that it even affects our memory. And we never remember from one day to the next the things that have come our way. When I broke the 5 loaves amongst 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments took you up? And they said unto him, 12. And when the 7 amongst 4,000, how many baskets full of fragments took you up? And they said, 7. And he said unto them, how is it that you do not understand? And what he really is soliciting here is a personal heart's admission to walk with you, talk with you, hear you and see you does nothing for us. We're dead in our sin. We're blind. We're alienated from the very life of God. Then he came to Bethsaida, and they bring a blind man unto him. And I warned you this was coming. And they besought him to touch him. Don't bother asking him to pray. He's got a new technique. He touches. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spat on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, I see men as trees walking. They're out of focus. It's not clear yet. And after that, he put his hands again on his eyes and made him look up. And he was restored and saw every man clearly. And he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town, nor tell it to any in the town. And once more, may I remind you that we have seen this constantly since we opened this gospel. Blessing comes with responsibility. Not just a blessing to be blessed and brag about. It comes with a responsibility. And Jesus went out, and his disciples, into the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And by the way, he asked his disciples, saying unto them, who do men say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist. But some say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. That's the trouble. There are so many varieties of theological opinion about you. It's no wonder it's hard for us to decide. But now Jesus narrows it down to the personal issue. And of course the gospel has that nature to it. It is not something that you come to as a democratic conclusion. It is an issue that's very personal to the individual heart. And he said unto them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered and said unto him, you are the Christ. Yes, the man that would end up failing was opening his heart up here for the first time and expressing what he really believed deep down inside, in spite of his sinfulness and weakness, thou art the Christ. And he charged them that they should tell no man about him. Surprise, isn't it? You'd think he would say, oh, you've learnt that. Well, the best thing to do is to get cracking, tell the world. No, what are they going to tell? A little knowledge is helpful, but it can be dangerous. They can't run around preaching that Christ will forgive. He hadn't died to do that. They can't say you'll get a new life. He hadn't died and risen again to give that. They couldn't talk about the incoming of the Holy Spirit. That was completely foreign to them at this present time. So simply knowing who he is not going to help. They have to wait, as he is having to wait, to the moment of redemption at the cross. The cross is central. That's why so many people leave it out today. Nice little talks about Jesus. But no application of the redemptive work of Christ at the cross on the life. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. detail after detail, but it meant nothing. And he spake that saying openly. And Peter, who with the one side of his heart can say, "Thou art the Christ," now turns round with that sin nature that's always there. And even after redemption and the work of the cross in your life, be always careful to remember that even today as Christians, those two natures are still very evident in your life. The new life, the old life, the flesh and the spirit, and they're contrary one to the other. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned about and looked on his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan. For thou savourest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men." I don't think he was talking to Peter. He saw what Peter didn't see. The enemy was there. He's appealing to the hearts of these men to think as men of the world. And that is never what God is after. And Satan's influence on these men is another reason he has to die to redeem them. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, "Whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Now would you please note, it's not talking about self-denial. We have seasons within the church calendar where people religiously practice self-denial. Once walking down the streets of Bristol, I overheard a young lady as she clip-clopped past me in high-heeled shoes talking to another lady and saying to her, "And I've given up my cigarettes and my chocolates for Lent." And I turned and shouted to her, "My dear, don't give up your cigarettes and chocolates for Lent." And she stopped, so did everybody in the street. And she turned and looked at me and said, "What did you say?" I said, "I was just saying, don't give up your cigarettes and chocolates for Lent." She said, "Why not?" I said, "Because God doesn't smoke, and he doesn't eat chocolates." She said, "Well, if I don't give him that, what can I give him?" I said, "Have you ever thought of trying to give him your heart instead of things?" Because that's the very issue that's at stake here. She walked away thinking I was crazy. And an awful lot of people still think that today, that this is a crazy demand. He's not asking for self-denial. He's asking for the total denial of yourself. Giving no room for self to live, move, breathe, be in control, but to be a life handed over to him. For whoever will save his life shall lose it. But whoever shall lose it, his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. I remember young people coming to me years ago, wanting to pour out their problems and have me help them as a leader. But the problems they began to speak to me about simply revive the memory in my own heart of my own unconverted and unredeemed days. And almost with a yell, I screamed to God in my heart, "No, no, I don't want to deal with this. It brings back too much of a memory of my own past." It was as almost as if a divine whisper came to the human heart and said, "Oh, saving yourself, are you? What does the word say? It says if I save myself, I'll lose it. That if I lose it for the gospel and the kingdom's sake, I'll find it." And I knew without hearing voices, I had to give myself to these young people and leave God with the consequences of saving me, and he has. And he makes it very plain here. "For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" What would you give in exchange for yours? You'd be amazed at the people I've questioned along this line. Even in evangelism, you get asked the question, do I have to stop dancing to become a Christian? And somehow or other they see dancing and salvation as equal. One is as valuable as the other. Do I have to give up eating my favourite food? Do I have to give up wearing lipstick? Do I have to give up smoking and drinking? Do I have to give up so many things to become a Christian? I usually respond, yes, even although it's not true. There's nothing you give up to become a Christian. The main thing you do is give in and give him your rotten heart to forgive and come in and give you a new life. But yet people still today have a value. What value do you have in your soul that you say this equals what Christ is offering? For what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. That's pretty plain. You don't even need a theological explanation for that, do you? Have you ever given him yourself? So he leaves them there. And now in this ninth chapter, he's going to pull aside from all that he's done so far. And he's going to show a select few something of the glory of his kingdom. And he said unto them, truly I say unto you, that there be some of them that stand here that shall not taste of death till they have seen the kingdom of God come with power. That wasn't looking forward to something away down in the future, because he fulfilled it just 6 days later. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John. A prospective failure and two temperamental sons of thunder. He took them with him. And they led them up into a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His kingdom was there in its power. And his clothes became shining, exceeding white as snow, so as no fuller on earth can white them. And there appeared unto them Elijah with Moses. And they were talking with Jesus. Another gospel tells us they were discussing his end that he should accomplish. Did you ever understand that? Moses, Elijah, and Jesus talking about this wonderful event that was so soon to take place. The very death of God himself on a cross to bring about redemption. And it's an accomplishment. His death is never the sad end to a good life, a poor martyr. It's the glorious consummation of all that God was waiting to bring to pass since this world first began to spin its way through space. It was an accomplishment. And Peter answered and said, typical of our dear brother, nobody's asked him anything. Another gospel tells us he butted in and said what he said because he didn't know what to say. There's still a lot of that going on today, isn't there? Say something for the sake of saying something when you've nothing to say. And Peter answered and said to him, Jesus, Master, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. I often wonder if Peter remembered that when Moses was on earth, he built a tabernacle, a temple and tents for God to dwell in. Was Peter here sort of letting Moses and Elijah see that even in the modern day and age, there are those that are younger, that have the stamina and the capacity and the desire and the will to do better than the old generation. Moses, you built one tabernacle, I'll have a bash at three. For he didn't know what to say, because they were afraid. And there was a cloud that overshadowed them. I always find it fascinating. We always talk about, if I could just see, I would believe. And here's Peter, James and John seeing Moses, seeing Elijah, and all it created in them was fear. And not only that, darkness descended in a cloud. Here is this overshadowing cloud, and a voice interrupted Peter's jabbering, his nothingness. God the Father. Not an inner voice. I'm always suspicious of inner voices. The voice of God the Father saying, "This is my beloved Son. Hear him." I don't know what that says to you, but I know how it comes across to me. Peter, would you just keep quiet for once in your life and listen to him? Oh, how much better our faith and trust in God would be if we would spend a bit more time just listening to him. And suddenly, when they'd looked round about, they saw no man anymore, save Jesus only with themselves. What an experience! A mountaintop experience! Have you ever longed for one? Be careful. It doesn't make a difference to them. And it wouldn't to you either. Because you may be allowed by God a beautiful experience that you would label mountaintop. But it's only temporary. You have to climb back down again and get into the dirt of the valley to face your next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and sometimes boring Sunday in the valley. Dishes to wash, laundry to be done, household chores, repairs, earning a living, meeting those neighbours that really upset you. Go down to church and listen to services and worship that upset you. It's not all mountaintop. Then there is that inner mess of your own spirit and heart. No wonder God interrupted the atmosphere when they were up there to say, "You'd be far better up here in those beautiful moments before you go back down to that valley to spend your time just listening to him." Before we go on to our next section in Mark, it might be a good thing just to listen to no more for a while, but go sit down and just listen to him. See you next time.